What does good fortune look like in war? For Paul Baumer and his comrades, it means receiving double rations of beans and sausage, not as a reward, but because half their company lies dead in the mud of the Western Front. This macabre inheritance sets the tone for one of literature's most devastating truths. War doesn't create heroes. It creates survivors who eat the food of the fallen and try not to think too hard about whose plate it came from. These young men, barely out of school with chalk dust still under their fingernails, were seduced into enlisting by their teacher, Cantarec, who painted glorious visions of defending the fatherland. He called them iron youth with pompous certainty, never imagining the iron that would tear through their bodies would come as shrapnel, not metals. This is where the illusion dies, in the gap between patriotic speeches and the weight of a dead friend's boots. Before combat, these boys endured 10 weeks of brutal transformation under Corporal Himmelstoss, a former postman drunk on authority. They salute laundry on clotheslines, crawl through mud under live fire, and collapse into bunks too exhausted to dream. This isn't training. It's systematic erasure, creating interchangeable parts for the war machine. Their first artillery bombardment shatters any romantic notions. Young Josef Baim loses his mind during shelling, screaming for his mother while friends restrain him from running into explosions. Another soldier, Kemmerich, vomits blood after a shell's concussive force ruptures his organs without leaving a mark, a death-defying nature itself. Veterans teach them a cruel curriculum, which sounds mean, imminent death, when to run or freeze, how to scavenge corpses. But the deeper lesson cuts harder. The enemy isn't the French soldiers across the trenches. It's death itself, an impartial harvester that cares nothing for nationality or the poetry they once wrote about glory. War obliterates civilized norms around the body. Soldiers defecate communally and discuss bowel movements like weather. Privacy becomes a quaint memory. When Kemmerich loses both legs, his yellow skin, blue lips, and sunken temples signal death's approach. Another soldier, his lower body gone, still pats out flames on his uniform, unaware most of him no longer exists. During an attack, Paul stabs a French soldier who jumps into his shell hole. Trapped with the dying man for hours, Paul watches him bleed out, sees the wedding ring, finds photos of a wife and daughter, reads the papers, Gerard Duval, a printer. This forced proximity to the enemy's humanity haunts Paul more than the killing itself. Yet soldiers develop uncanny resilience, sensing danger before shells land, distinguishing calibers by sound, aging decades in months. Food offers fleeting transcendence from constant misery. The body becomes both battlefield and refuge, vulnerable yet hyper-aware, degraded yet fiercely alive. Paul's leave reveals a disturbing truth. He belongs nowhere. His father demands heroic stories, refusing reality. His dying mother senses his change, but cannot comprehend it. Civilians debate trivial matters, money, status, blissfully ignorant of mortality in ways that seem childish. His former headmaster wants military strategy, but Paul knows only individual horrors, not newspaper abstractions. Language fails. Words like glory and sacrifice ring hollow after witnessing men choking on gas or disemboweled by shrapnel. Even with family, he sits behind invisible glass, visible but untouchable. He watches his mother's hands, hears his father's voice, but they exist in parallel realities that never connect. By leave's end, he's almost eager to return, where comrades understand without explanation. "I am not myself here," he realizes. "They are people I used to know, but I do not belong with them anymore." The war has created permanent exile, even among those who love him most. If any redemption exists in this vision of war, it lives in the bonds between soldiers. Paul's friendship with Kat, a 40-year-old former cobbler, becomes his emotional anchor. Kat possesses an almost supernatural ability to find food, predict danger, and read incoming artillery by sound alone. When Paul carries the wounded cat toward help, only to discover a tiny shrapnel fragment has killed him, the loss devastates him more than any other death. This comradeship transcends normal friendship. These men share everything, protect each other through artillery fire, and cross class boundaries impenetrable in civilian life. Farmer, student, and factory worker become equals in the trenches. Their shared experiences, dividing a stolen goose, huddling together during bombardments, forge bonds stronger than any pre-war relationships. Yet death randomly breaks these connections. Kemmerich dies from an infected wound. Muller takes a bullet to the stomach. By the novel's end, Paul is the last survivor of his original group, each loss diminishing him until he himself seems almost a ghost, highlighting the ultimate futility of even these precious bonds against war's overwhelming destructive power. The ground transforms into something both sacred and horrifying. During bombardments, soldiers press themselves into the soil with desperate intimacy. To no man does the earth mean so much as to the soldier, Paul reflects. When he presses himself down upon her, then she is his only friend, his brother, his mother. Yet this nurturing earth becomes progressively saturated with death. Bodies decompose into the soil, sometimes emerging after heavy rains to create a grotesque landscape where the living fight among the dead. Shell craters transform familiar terrain into an alien moonscape. Poison gas clings to low-lying areas, turning the ground itself into a weapon. When Paul and his comrades shelter in a cemetery during a fierce attack, they hide among the dead to avoid joining them, using centuries-old coffins as shields against modern shrapnel. The earth holds no allegiance to nation or ideology, caring nothing for the artificial boundaries men draw across its surface. In the end, it becomes the great equalizer, accepting friend and foe alike, erasing the distinctions that drove them to kill each other. Paul dies in October 1918, just weeks before the armistice. The military reports state simply, "All quiet on the Western Front." His death merits no special mention, merely another statistic in the vast machinery of war. The bureaucratic coldness reveals the ultimate truth. An entire generation was destroyed not just by bullets and shells, but by a system that reduced human lives to brief, impersonal entries in military ledgers. Even those who survived physically carried the war within them forever, in nightmares and memories, in their permanent exile from the civilian world. The tragedy isn't just the millions who died, but the future stolen, the potential extinguished, the innocence that can never be recovered. This brutal honesty remains essential in our era of sanitized media coverage and remote warfare. It strips away the abstractions and euphemisms that make war palatable to those who don't experience it directly, forcing us to confront not just physical destruction, but the moral and psychological devastation that follows when societies send their young to kill and die for causes that rarely justify such sacrifice.